Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter. And that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Greetings and salutations, everyone. Greetings and salutations. We have another great show in store for you today. So let's take a look at what's on tap. Today we talk about justice for Michael Brown. We look at some of the fundamental questions that would help get to the bottom of Darryl Wilson allegedly murdering Mike Brown. We also take a look at the Louisville purge. I introduce a subject today that most people are not really talking about, and it's really called one-way trade. We also look at Rick Perry, the implication for a blue state, and the fact that will Republicans begin to run away from Rick Perry. And, of course, at the top of the next hour, we talk about Black Acre, an exciting new blog from Leo Baron Hicks. We discuss this and much, much more. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, before we get started, I have to do this. I have to give a shout out to my darling mother. Her birthday is today. That's right. Happy birthday to my mother, Mary Jo Cook, out there in Alabama. Yes, indeed. My darling mother, she is, I'm not going to tell you how old she is, but she's doing well for her age, I should say. So, without further ado, let's get to the topic at hand. That is justice for our friend Michael Brown. And I want to do this in a way that pretty much breaks it down into three specific components. I want to take a look at the timeline of the incident, and I want to take a look at the key players of the activity, and also then want to take a look at some of the arguments for the officer and some of the arguments against the officer. I want to take a look at the Michael Brown case in those three specific ways. Now, of course, to help me break all of this down is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises and the author of Reflections, What I Know to Be True. I introduce the some and present the others, no other than Jima Hill Cook. Jima, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Wonderful, wonderful. So what we're going to do today, we're going to specifically break this Mike Brown issue down into three ways. One, I want to take a look at the timeline. What are the activities or events that led up to the murdering or the allegedly murdering of Mike Brown? And I want to take a look at the key players and, you know, how they are participating in the activities, the transparency or lack of transparency. Now I want to take a look at some arguments for the officers. So let's take a look at the timeline. Now, the timeline has been pretty much dissected by several organizations. We're going to take a look at the timeline proposed by USA Today, and we're going to look at an extension of the timeline proposed by the Washington Post. Now, the timeline presented by USA Today says around 11:48 to around noon, about 10 minutes to noon on Saturday, August the 9th, an officer responds to a call of a sick person. Now, this officer has been now identified as Darren Wilson. Now, Darren Wilson responds to a call of a sick person. This happens around a little bit before noon. And almost concurrently, around 11:51 a.m., another call, not related to the sick call, another entirely different call comes in about a robbery at a convenience store. And the dispatcher gives a description of the robber and said that the suspect is walking towards Quick Trip convenience store. Now, mind you, these are two separate and apart incidents. Now, at 12:01, the officer encountered Michael Brown and a friend as they walked down the street. Now, the Darren Wilson police officer encounters Michael Brown walking down the street. He is not addressing the later we know to be the victim, and later to know that the other person that was with him was Dorian Johnson. These two individuals walking down the street, Wilson had no idea, did not make any relationship between these two gentlemen walking down the street and the robbery taking place. Now, quite naturally, there's some activities taking place. These activities are in dispute. The specific activities that took place are in dispute. However, we do know one of the key players that we'll mention in a minute was an eyewitness because he was there. Dorian Johnson was there. He gave an exact account of what he saw. He gave several interviews of what happened. Now, of course, around noon, Brown is shot to death as a result of these activities or a result of this encounter. The encounters that takes place in this short period of time, 10 minutes when Wilson sees them and he pulls them to the side, the accounts that Dorian gave was that he was driving down the street. He asked the two gentlemen to move out of the middle of the street. He pulls up to him, opens his door, and enough to hit Mike Brown, pulls him to the car. A scuffle takes place. He pulls out his weapon and he says he's going to shoot Michael Brown. And in fact, shoots him. He runs away. At this point, Wilson gets out the car and shoots Brown in the back. Brown then turns around with his hands up in the air. Now, by this time, if we stop and pause at this particular moment in time, other eyewitnesses come in and see Brown with his hands up. So between the officer actually encountering Mike Brown in the police car and the activities that took place, how it happened, Dorian gave an account of that. But when the rounds start being fired, other people start looking at them. And then most people that talks about what they saw, and these were separate incidents, said that Brown had his hands up, both, and then was being fired upon repeatedly. Then around 12:04, a second officer arrives on the scene, followed by a supervisor at 12:05, and then an ambulance did come on the scene. And in fact, we have video of Brown laying in the street in about a 7 minute time span when he was laying there. We did see someone come in with some medical equipment, and they did touch the body and check to see if he was alive or not. So all of these activities are eyewitnesses accounts. This is video account, and this is a key witness testimony within a 10 minute time frame. And so some of the key players, as I mentioned, was Michael Brown, the victim, Dorian Johnson, the key eyewitness, Darren Wilson, the police officer who allegedly murdered Michael Brown, then the convenience store clerk, the police chief, the governor, and then Ron Johnson, Eric Holder, and then, of course, the media. And the reason why I say the media is a key player at this period of time is primarily because we can now keep the focus on the activities that are taking place. Okay, so that's kind of the activities or events that led up to the murdering of Michael Brown, or allegedly murdering of Michael Brown by Darren Wilson. And so to this point, the things that we don't know, those are the facts. These things that we don't know is, where is the 911 tape? The official 911. Why is it taking 7, 8, 9 days for them to release it? Where is the autopsy report? In fact, the Eric Holder is now asking for a separate autopsy to be conducted by his agency. Right? Why are they asking for something different than what Ferguson is offering? It seems like there's no transparency. So we take a look at these questions, and we want to get you to weigh in. And to weigh in, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Gina, so let's take a look at these. So let's start off. Let me start off by this. I want to get into the arguments for and the arguments against the police officer. Before I do that, let's talk about some other activities that took place. And this is the releasing of the video of Michael Brown robbing the store. Where's the relevancy of that releasing that video?
Well, there isn't any relevancy, and I believe that's what the big to-do has been about, and what the frustration with the people of Ferguson, as well as those of us that are watching from afar, is that you release the video at the same time you finally, after 5 days and much pressure, give us the name of the officer who fired those fatal blows into Michael Brown. And so that's all we were asking for, was the name of the officer. You give us that, but you camouflage it, you cover it up, you hide it under a rock with this video and these still photos of Michael Brown, allegedly, and Dorian Johnson, allegedly, robbing a store, which it really wasn't new information, because Dorian, in one of his previous interviews, had mentioned something about some cigars anyway. So the intent was always to discredit the victim here, the person that lay dead in the street for 4 hours. That was the intent, because if it was not the intent, then you would have been upfront and forthright with all of those involved. The Department of Justice told you not to release it. The governor did not even know you were going to release it. The person who was in charge of securing the area, Captain Ron Johnson, did not know you were going to release it. So when you do things like that under cloak and dagger, under darkness, you are perpetuating what we've all come to accept about your department from the police department, and that is, you're not above reproach. You tend to do things in the dark, and you just expect people to go along with it because you're the police department. But it's a new day, and it's too many cameras and videos and phones and witnesses that are coming forth on exactly what happened that day. So the releasing of the video, it only fueled the fire, and I just hope that we get back to the officer. Who is he? You know, we hear he's a great officer, and he's been on the force for 6 years or whatever, and but who is he? And that he hasn't had any disciplinary action. Well, let's talk about that. What does that mean exactly? Break that down to me. Does that mean that things went unsubstantiated, or does that mean there was none ever filed? See, that's two different issues. And so we just can't take what you say, Ferguson Police Department, because you say it, because you're proving yourself to be untrustworthy. So the release of the video was nothing but smoke and mirrors to get us talking about the video and whether or not it was him or not, which is still irrelevant. Whether or not it was him is irrelevant. If he was shot in the back and he had his hands up saying, basically I surrender, don't shoot, and you continue to shoot, I don't care what he stole from that convenience store. He did not have to be gunned down in the street like a dog.
Yeah, I definitely have to agree with you. And I want to say this because I need to get this off my chest. And I want to get this disclaimer out there because many people will call in to the show and talk about, you know, and we will ultimately get there, but we should be discussing black-on-black crime just as passionately are when we have a police officer involved. And I agree with that. And that's a discussion for another day. And people will call in and say, you know, he was certainly should not be stealing and putting himself in a position. And I certainly agree with that as well. And then you will hear other arguments for, you know, being involved and voting and things of that nature. I am certainly in agreement with those issues. But as you said, killing an unarmed man with his hands up is also wrong. And that is the context that we're going to be discussing today. So with that in mind, I want to make sure that the comments stay within that context right now. And so I want to, you know, unpack what you said because you had a lot of powerful things in there. And the one thing about smoke and mirrors, it seems like there have been a lot of smoke and mirrors when it comes to this particular situation. Smoke and mirrors literally with tear gas, curfews, the video being displayed, the fact that they're bringing out these armored vehicles. Now, mind you, none of this had anything to do with the police officer allegedly murdering Mike Brown. None of this had anything to do with the issue of his character, the issue of all the things you just mentioned with respect to him allegedly murdering Mike Brown. So what is it about the smoke and mirrors do you think the Ferguson Police Department is doing as opposed to addressing the case?
Well, to address the case would mean they have to admit culpability, admit that they were wrong, admit that the shooting of Michael Brown was unjustified and illegal. And so they would have to deal with that. So instead of dealing with that, they're going to try to sway us. They're going to try to get the people to get so frustrated and so angry that we're talking more about the rioting allegedly and the looting allegedly and maybe some violence or whatever, as opposed to talking about this police department that has yet to do what most police departments by now would have done. And so, you know, that's the whole reason why for the smoke and mirrors. The smoke and mirrors is nothing more than trying to keep us from asking the hard questions, because I don't know if you've seen any of the police captain's press conferences, but he's very good at dodging. He doesn't answer anything. And so talking about where he's not even there, talking about different things, and keep them off the hook. You know, the governor shouldn't have to be answering the question about why it's taking them so long to release the officer's name or autopsy. That should come from the police department. And if they are no longer handling the investigation, then who is? And that's who we need to talk to, and that's who needs to provide us these answers. So the smoke and mirrors is just more of a tactic. It's a strategy to see how long they can keep us off focus, keep us asking about things that are not that important. The bottom line is, who is the officer? And what made him decide to shoot that young man the amount of times that I've heard, at least 5 times. And he had no weapon, and he was on his knees with his hands up, which means he was no longer fleeing, and he was not a threat to the officer at all.
You know,
I understand the job and role of a police officer is difficult, and you have to make judgment decisions at that moment. But after your first shot and your second shot, and now he's down, I don't think you need to unload him on somebody that's down with their hands up. I understand you have a tough job. But at some point, common sense got to sneak in there too somewhere. But if you think that you are above the law and that you'll be protected and you'll be covered up, maybe that's because it's happened before and that's what happened. Who knows? People only do things they can get away with when they've gotten away with it before.
Yeah. Speaking of getting away with something, getting away with murder indeed, is that, you know, I mentioned many times when we have incidents involving African-American males, particularly around police or people involved killing them or murdering them, as in allegedly in this particular case, is this a, you know, is this right out of the playbook of George Zimmerman? You know, I mentioned the fact that when you get a victory such as George Zimmerman, it sets precedence for killing for black life. It sets precedence. It says, yes, it's okay because, you know, the jury have voted for it in the past, so it must be okay. So here, people are taking black lives. If you look at the increased incidence of black people dying, particular men, black males dying, at the hand of violent crimes when they're unarmed, it has grown exponentially. Now, I don't have any of the specific numbers or any of the specific research behind that, but it's certainly the perception of, or especially the reporting of these events, are now made widely known. So when it comes to George Zimmerman's playbook, i.e. smearing the victim, is that a case in this particular situation, speaking of smoke and mirrors, when they released this videotape?
Of course. I mean, like I said, I think it's nothing more than just another tactic to try to get us off of our game, as though if he was a criminal, his life is less valuable. And we say we're a country that values life because we have all these pro-life people around here. And we say we're a country that values life. Well, if we value life, we value life. Whether that life is someone who is innocent, which I think we're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. So even for the alleged crime that he allegedly committed, he had not been charged and had not been found guilty yet. So he's presumed innocent, period. And so that also is what's getting lost, is that we're forgetting our own laws and rules and constitution about who we are as a nation, because we're blinded by color and we're blinded by race and we're blinded by power. And so because of that, we lose sight of who we are. Our moral compass is completely off. It no longer exists. And we allow officers to hide behind the badge, to hide behind the color blue, to band together, to cover up evidence, to get rid of evidence, to frame people. And we've seen it over and over again. We've seen in the last 10 years, we've seen more people exonerated that's been found guilty of a crime they kept saying they didn't commit. The number of people that have been released from death row or released out of prison because new evidence shows, oh, they're right, they didn't do it. So for some reason, we've allowed all of those things I mentioned to blind us from true justice. Lady Justice is supposed to be blind. And right now, I'm not seeing blindness at all. And so we've got to take them where they are. And, you know, as a counselor, I always say, you have to meet people where they are. Well, if we meet Ferguson Police Department where they are, they've shown us who they are. Maya Angelou said, when people show you who they are, believe them. He's shown us that he's untrustworthy. He's shown us that he's a liar. He's shown us that he wants to cover up something. Not sure what that is, but you don't run around doing all this cloak and daggers. You're not trying to hide something. So what is it that you're trying to hide, Mr. Police Sergeant? What is it? And so that's the question that we need to be asking.
You know, there's an argument. You talked about the courts and Lady Justice being blind, but there's an argument that the courts have ruled over and over by shooting a fleeing felon. This is this notion of a fleeing felon, right, in the back who may cause harm to the public is justified, right? And so there will be some arguments for that. But there's also, and just, and this is why we should really get involved and get more knowledge when it comes to these issues. Because actually, the fleeing felon, there's more to it than meets the eye. The courts in the United States have ruled that deadly force is not allowed unless the suspect poses a significant threat of death or serious bodily harm to the officers or others. And it is clear in this case that that is not the situation that was before us. So you hear this notion of shooting a fleeing felon, but the law is very clear. Under U.S. law, the fleeing felon rule was limited to non-lethal force in most cases. This is by Tennessee versus Garner in 1985. Fleeing felons may be allowed into places not open to the public without a warrant if the officer is in hot pursuit. So this use of deadly force is not authorized in all cases, especially when a fleeing felon. Now, granted, we still have to go through the whole notion of being presumed innocent. And more importantly, these two cases I mentioned by the timeline were separate and apart. They were an autonomous event. The state of mind that comes into play was he did not ask them to be to move out of the way, out of the street, because they were suspects. He's asked them to move out of the street because, you know, either he was antagonizing them or he was harassing them allegedly or something. But it was not related, at least his questioning by the eyewitness was not related to the actual events that took place in the robbery. So, again, this argument, this fleeing felon argument, is invalid when it comes to this particular instance. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that after the break. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I want to continue the conversation now about what's happening in Ferguson. I want to talk a little bit about the situation on the ground with respect. You know, we were talking about smoke and mirrors early on, and I only consider smoke and mirrors to be what the media is covering because that's what we see. They're feeding this notion of all of this activity happening rather than focusing on or asking questions about the 911 tapes or the autopsy, whether or not they're waiting on a toxicology report, the fact that Eric Holder is asking for a different autopsy report. They're focusing on the riots. This is what the media is showing you. They're focusing on the curfew, the sound bites, things of that nature. So Jima, I ask you, is Ferguson, the city of Ferguson, conducting themselves in a manner that will get the best results? Meaning that this looting, this rioting, this when you have a press conference and people are yelling out and not to have a real, a true dialogue, is this behavior conducive to good results?
Well, now, the activist in me will have to take you back to the time of King and Malcolm and that era when we were informed by way of recordings, I believe, from the FBI, that they will take people to agitate and cause a disturbance. And so we cannot for sure say that the people that are being disruptive are actually from the city of Ferguson, nor can we say whether or not they very well may be from there, but they may also have been given some incentive to be disruptive.
Get your hand in my pocket type deal.
Get your hand out my pocket, you know. And as we go back in history and you look at what happened in Memphis with Reverend King at the sanitation strike, it came out that the agitators had been brought in to do just what they did, to disrupt, to distract, and to put a mark on the peaceful protest. So, you know, I can't with certainty say that that's not happening in 2014, because there's always someone that will be that person. And, you know, we joked about it back when the movie came out, Django Unchained. We talked about Samuel L. Jackson's character. Well, there's a lot of Samuel L. Jackson characters running around. Let's not play like everybody is on board and everybody wants things to be right in Ferguson, or St. Louis, or New York, or L.A., Dallas, you know, Florida. You know, let's not play like, wants things to be in order, because they don't. There's money to be made in disorder. There's money to be made off of the backs of the poor and off of the disenfranchised. So I can't, you know, with 100% certainty say that the people that are causing the distraction don't have an incentive to do so. So because of that, I'm not paying that much attention to that, because I don't know where it's coming from.
Yeah. And, you know, there's some reports on the ground that's also saying the people of Ferguson is really standing up against these riots. They're blocking people from even actually going in there and doing the looting. So, I mean, there's a lot of validity to what you're saying. I mean, A, there's historical precedence for it. B, we know that there are some Samuel Jacksons out there, not him, but the character he played in Django. And then C, the fact that people will make a dollar any way they can or capitalize on any situation they can. So, you know, there's a lot of validity to what you're saying. And so this could perhaps be the case that's sucking on all the attention, because we're really not paying attention to the facts of the case. So now, having said that, let's talk about Ron Johnson on the ground. What do you think his impact on the entire situation over the last several days?
Well, I think what he brought to the community was a sense of familiarity and a sense of calm, because he's from there. They know him. His family lives there. He's grown up there. So he brought a sense of familiarity, and they know he is a good guy. If he wasn't a good guy, we would know that by now, because there would have been some talk about what y'all bringing him in for. But you haven't gotten that. So that lets you know that they trust him. They trust him, the man, more than they trust him, the officer. They trust him, the man. So that's important. It's critical. And I think because of his tone and tenor and the passion and compassion that he has, one can only hope that that will then begin to spread to some of the other officers in whom he's in charge of, so that they understand if you show people respect, they will give you respect. But you can't be yelling and cussing at me and telling me to, you know, do however you're going to tell it to me and expect me to respond to that in a nice, calm manner. It's not going to work like that. So I think he brings familiarity. He brings a sense of calmness. He brings a level of respect to the people that they had not felt before. And because he's from that community, has ties in that community, still is in that community. So because of that, people will trust him when he says, I'm here for you. They will trust him when he says, you know, I'm scared just like you are. They trust him when he says, I wept last night because of this situation, but I'm here again, and I'm going to be here with you until this is done. They trust him on that.
You know, and that's a model, I think, that should permeate throughout our society for all police officers, right? To first have that relationship with the community before you try to police the community. You know, the whole fact of the compassion, the passion, the familiarity that you talked about, all of this you do and you build rapport as you establish a relationship. And so it's going to be interesting moving forward to see what the new model, because I certainly believe that this will change the dynamic of policing forever. You know, and it is not just Mike Brown's situation, but it's all the issues that led up to this, right? This is the tipping point. You know, when you hear Ferguson talk about no justice, no peace, I believe that now, because there has not been truly a peaceful situation in a very long time. Now, not to say a disruption, but they're certainly having a lot of civil disobedience. It doesn't have to be in the form of looting or rioting, but civil disobedience is a step in the right direction that says, hey, we're not going to just let this go away. And they do deserve these answers. But I believe that Johnson's approach is certainly will change the dynamics of policing around the nation. And what's interesting is that, you know, the impact that he's had because he's from that community, the impact that Eric Holder is having because he's from a similar community. And so I ask you now about Eric Holder's involvement, and what do you think Eric Holder's impact on this situation has been on the developments in Ferguson?
Well, once again, Eric Holder brings to the table a sense of familiarity and a sense of calm and a sense of doing business. All people want is to be heard, to be listened to, and to be respected. And what Eric Holder brings is he brings the respect of the Department of Justice to this situation. And what he's saying to the people is, something about what you're saying, I need to investigate. I don't know what it all is, but something about this doesn't seem right. And there seems to be, there may have been some violations. And the only way I'm going to be able to make a determination as to where to proceed is then we must investigate. So he's not coming in making any promises about anything, but he's saying we will investigate. We will take a look at this to see if or what and how many civil rights violations were happened towards Michael Brown. We will also take a look at, this was a request from Attorney Trump, who is the attorney for the family of Michael Brown, that there be an independent autopsy coming in from the Department of Justice to look for the trajectory of the bullets, how many times was he shot, where was the bullet casing, where was he when he was shot, all of those things that the people on the street already know because you have those witnesses that saw it. So when you got the witnesses on the street, and if you've seen any footage from where the body was, that's in an apartment complex area, several different apartments over there. And it's a Saturday afternoon. You know, people are just out, just maybe hanging out on their balcony or just coming back in from grocery store or whatever they're doing on a Saturday afternoon. And this is what you hear thinking, what? It couldn't be firecrackers. It's 12 o'clock in the day. Ain't nobody doing that. And then you hear it again, and you know what a gunshot sound like. You know, even though the bus has moved up to the suburbs, I know what a gunshot sounds like. And so, you know, I'm looking to see what's going on and to hear the number of stories. And then to hear today that the FBI has identified two or three additional witnesses that had not spoken to anyone before. So now you have the three that we all know about, and now you have three additional witnesses that have been identified because the FBI is down on the ground going door-to-door knocking, asking people. You got Ron Johnson at the press conference yesterday giving out cards of the FBI people that if anybody want to talk, if you got something to say, you got something to share, you got some information, here's who you need to talk to. And so disseminating that information so that it's getting to the right people. Eric Holder, along with Ron Johnson, brings that sense of familiarity, a sense of respect, knowing that the people are going to be heard, and that they feel like something will be done. Whatever that something is, they feel like something will be done.
You know, and Eric Holder has been my man from since day one. I mean, he's been really going after this injustice, if you will. So, but I wonder, though, what do you make of the arguments people are making about the president's involvement vis-a-vis Eric Holder's involvement? Why is it then that the community, that's, especially when it comes to African-Americans or black people, are saying that the president's involvement is not enough? What are they expecting from the president, especially when he's dispatching someone like Eric Holder because they can really do something other than make a speech? What do you make of these arguments?
Well, I'm going to say they expect him to walk on water and then say it's ice. So it really doesn't matter what he does. If he had said nothing, they would be talking about that. He spoke about it twice now. He spoke before the governor of the state said anything. And we've yet to hear an apology from the city of Ferguson, St. Louis County, St. Louis Police Department, for the loss of life of Michael Brown. We've heard from Ron Johnson, who is the Missouri Department of Highway Patrol, apologize to the family and apologize. But we haven't heard. That's what we need to be putting energy on. President's going to do what he's going to do. And although I love Michael Eric Dyson and I love Dr. James Peterson and you know, I'm in a love-hate relationship with Melissa Harris Perry, you know, and all these intellectuals and doctors and professors, you know, I value their intellect. I don't discount it. But every now and then they go off the track, and this is one of those times they've gone off the track. I'm not saying the president doesn't need to be held accountable, but he is using what he's supposed to use, and that's the Department of Justice.
Right, right, exactly.
That's who you want. If he comes out and gives a speech and don't dispatch the Department of Justice, what's the point? If Eric Holder never shows up and DOJ is never on the ground and the FBI is never on the ground, what is the point of the president coming out speaking about how disappointed he is or hurt or whatever he is with the situation, but he doesn't do anything to address what the people on the ground talking about? Then we just say he's empty. He's just giving us platitudes and he's just giving us words. So whether he speaks or not, and I even said this to somebody on Twitter, they were talking about the optics of the president speaking from Martha's Vineyard while he's on vacation as opposed to being in Washington. Well, ain't nobody else in Washington. The Congress ain't there. So when are you going to go there for and talk? Congress is not there. Nothing can be done until they get back. They already suing them for executive action. So what are you going to go and do? Just be in Washington? That's a waste of time. So I think, you know, him having had the conversations with Eric Holder, and then his senior advisor, Valerie Jarrett. Valerie Jarrett is talking directly to the people. She's talking to Reverend Al Sharpton. She's talking to the NAACP, the new guy. She's talking to the local chapter president down there in Ferguson and St. Louis. She's talking to the governor. And if anybody has the ear of the president outside of Michelle and his two daughters, it's Valerie Jarrett. So if Valerie Jarrett is getting this information from what's happening on the ground, you can best believe the president is getting it, and he's making decisions based on that. He's not going to get caught up in all our emotions and about all we want him to do. He's going to make and this is who he's been his whole presidency. So I'm not sure why now we expect him to do something different. Yeah, you can say he only got 2 years left, and he ought to come in and do whatever. But if he's going to do it, let's let him do it right. That's, you know, the idea is to have an impact on policy. I don't just need a speech. I need to know what's going to come out of this. What's going to come out of all of this equipment that local police departments have now that they got from the federal government? You know, are we going to change that? Is somebody going to put a, you know, let's have a bill about that. Let's make some changes to that. Because they don't, what you need all this militarized equipment for, and we ain't in war in the United States of America. You have waged a war on certain economic communities that you haven't waged everywhere else. President, or what he has to say, is not as important to me as it is what policies are going to be enacted because of this. What changes are going to be made in the city of Ferguson, in the county of St. Louis, in the state of Missouri that will have a lasting impact not only on that state but the rest of the 49? That's what we need to be talking about.
And you know what's interesting is that any time that the president does get involved, i.e. Henry Louis Gates, Trayvon Martin, it then becomes a political issue, and you really you add to the smoke and mirrors, if you will. You add to the fact that now you get other people involved. They start talking about what the president said, how he said it, what he did, as opposed to all the things you just mentioned, getting things done, dispatching Valerie Jarrett, dispatching Eric Holder to really impact policy. And so this whole notion of the president is not doing enough is ludicrous to me. And it just pains me, especially our people that really don't understand that Barack Obama is not there to just make speeches. He's really there to cause an impact on our society, a long-term impact. If you look at the policies that he's putting in place, he's always looking at something for the long term. When he leaves office, can he still have an America that his daughters can grow up in and be proud of? You know, and so this whole notion that the president is not doing enough is just crazy. I want to shift now to an issue that you brought up that I think is very important. Is this militarization of the police department? And I want to look at that in the context when you have a Clyde Bundy who has automatic weapons and they put up a front and they do this. They have a big standoff and you don't have that type of show of force. And then you have something as simple as the people of a city that's unarmed protesting. And then you have this type of show of force. What is happening in America that we need to have armed IED prepared vehicles to come out and against our citizens in this manner? Why do we need these?
Short answer is we don't. There's nothing that has happened in here lately in the United States of America that these types of weapons and vehicles and riot gear and face masks and gas masks and all these sorts of things, tear gas and pellet bullets and balloon bullets or whatever they call. I don't know where we needed that at in the United States of America. Now, there are certain times, and truth be told, now this is the cynic in me, if we needed to see sort of militarization of the police department, it should have been up in Nevada with the Bundy people.
Exactly.
Pointing rifles at federal agents. You didn't have any people down in Ferguson pointing any weapons at those police officers. Nobody had that. So where we needed to have a show of force, we didn't do nothing. We this man ain't paid taxes in 20 years. And you going and you letting him and his people just run free up there and point guns and threaten and do all sorts of things. So what, Nevada doesn't have all these weapons? Then Missouri needs to send some up there.
Exactly.
If you're going to use it, show some force. That's where you need to show it, not down there. But, that's the cynic in me. But, there's really no need for it. And if it is, it's on such a small scale, we don't need that many. And there are too many small towns in America that have this type of equipment. And I need to know why, and I need to know where is it being stored, because there are crazy people in the world who will come and steal it, and now what?
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
you know, we're coming up here on the second break, but I want to talk about your friend, your buddy, your old pal, Al Sharpton. You know, when I played commercial not too long ago, and he talked about your birthday, not to mention you have another birthday coming up in a few days, it reminded me of the conversation y'all had when he was talking about the birthday. So it was just interesting. And so I want to ask the question about Al Sharpton, your buddy, old pal, is that people say they are not relevant anymore in the 21st century. Is there a purpose for an Al Sharpton, for a Reverend Al Sharpton? Is there a purpose for a Reverend Jesse Jackson in the 21st century?
Let me tell you something about Reverend Al, because he's going to keep it real. That's the name of his show on Sirius, on Urban View 126, if you got Sirius XM. Check him out every day from 12 to 3. Here's what he's going to do. He's going to keep it real. That's a plug for Reverend Al. But he's going to keep it real. Here's what he said to the crowd today. What he said to the crowd today is, you got 20,000 of y'all in the city of Ferguson, and only 15 of y'all voted in the last election. 1,500 voted out of 20,000. He said, what you're doing is an insult to your children. That's what Reverend Al said today to the people in Ferguson at the rally. So, yes, is there a need for a Reverend Al? Yes, sir. Is there a need for a Reverend Jackson? Yes, sir. You know why? Because they have the means to galvanize the people. They have the means to speak truth to power. We may not like how it comes dressed up. We may not like the suit he have on. We may not like the vernacular that he uses, the southernness of Reverend Jackson and the boldness of Reverend Al. But I guarantee you, if don't nothing else happen in Ferguson, you're going to have more than 1,500 people going to vote next time. I guarantee you that. Because the world just sat up here and said, how can you have 53 officers on your police and only three of them be black and 70% of the community is black? Everybody asking that question. And you got a school board where there's no blacks and 70% of the population is black. And you got a city council that has, I think, one, well, they didn't say it was black. They said a person of color, so we don't know who that is. But you still got a 70-80% population. So somebody, you know, the city and the people of Ferguson got to go make some moves too. So Reverend Al coming in and Reverend Jesse coming in and Martin Luther King III coming in, all these other people coming in are there to galvanize and support. But the people on the ground, the people that live in Ferguson got to step up to the plate. You know, at the top of the hour, you'll be talking to Leo, and Leo often talks about, as much as it is responsibility to reach back, the hand I'm reaching down to get, got to reach up to grab mine. And so once Jesse and Al and all of them leave, some people in Ferguson got some work to do. If the DOJ comes out tomorrow and says, you're right, the officer needs to be arrested for murder, that's just the beginning. You still got to change some stuff. You can't change nothing if you don't have people in place to make those changes happen. So you still got to vote. You still got to get registered. You still got to go to your child's PTA meeting. See what's happening in your child's school. You still need to be available at the school board meetings, at the city council meetings. See what's going on in your city. See, Michael Brown was the tipping point. So what the people are frustrated about, it's not just Michael Brown. Michael Brown is what came out of the different time that nobody ever heard them. And then you would have the naysayers, what's so different about him? He ain't the only person that been shot by the police. He may not have been the only person, but let's make sure he's the last unarmed black man shot in Ferguson, shot in St. Louis County that's unarmed by the police. Let's make sure he's the last one. That's what the people of Ferguson have to do, and that's what the Reverend Al and the Reverend Jackson do. They uncover what's trying to be covered. And say what you want about him, how you feel about him. There's no need for him. He's just a rebel rouser. He don't go nowhere he's not called. The grandfather called him and said, I, as the family, we need you here. Every day he's been there, he's called for peace. He's not calling for people to go, you know, he's like looting. He said, we're not looters, we're liberators. Now, go put that on the T-shirt. He said, we're not looters.
That's right.
He said, we're not looters, we liberators. So we come in here to liberate the city of Ferguson, but the city of Ferguson got some work to do. Y'all got some cleaning up y'all got to do. You got 20,000 people, and only 1,500 of y'all went and voted. That's a sin and a shame. So you can't be fussing at Ron Johnson, because I'm pretty sure he went and voted. What were you doing?
So that's a good point. I want you to make a direct correlation for the listeners out there and for the people that will go out later and pick this up that are not actively listening today, because we got several people out in the chat room. We got, you know, a few callers on the line. And when they go out and share these messages for the day, make the direct correlation between voting and Mike Brown, right? Because people will say, well, Mike Brown got shot and he and the police did it and the police is the problem and they need to do better policing. And why are we talking about voting? Draw that line for the people so they know that is a voting that is has a direct correlation to what happened with Mike Brown.
Well, here's what we say all the time. We say all the time that all politics is local. So if you're not voting in your local elections, you don't know what things the city, the county, the state are putting in the books in the state of Missouri, because you don't have a clue. You don't know what laws are being passed. What laws are being passed and then voted on by the people, because you're not voting. So, you know, to receive the military, you know, all that equipment and stuff, somebody had to come up with that somewhere, and it was agreed to. And people voted on it and said, oh, okay, yeah, we need some here in Ferguson. Well, who said that? Who is this police chief that feels it's okay to be dishonest and lie and cover up a crime? Because if he cover up one crime, he'll cover up another one. And if he's covering up one, he's already covered up another. So is he in an elected position? Is he in an appointed position? Because if he's in an appointed position, then who appointed him? Because whoever appointed him needs to be dealt with. Then you get him out. If he's an appointment of the mayor, you vote the mayor out because the mayor is not putting people in that need and have the best interest of Ferguson. That's what voting does. Voting gives you power. And we have been lulled to sleep that voting doesn't really count. But I read somewhere that if it didn't count, they wouldn't be trying to take it away from you.
That's right. And not to mention the people that sit on jurors elections are directly out of voter registration. And
exactly.
So even if he goes to trial and you don't have anybody from that jury pool that's on the jury, then you still got a problem. So, there's a direct correlation between voting.
That's right.
And this is why Reverend Al, Reverend Jesse Jackson continues to push this issue because it begins to give us power back. You know, they wouldn't have all these gerrymandering of districts if voting didn't matter. They wouldn't put
mm-hmm.
they wouldn't put laws in the books about ID cards if voting didn't matter. They wouldn't move
mm-hmm.
the days or shorten the days if voting didn't matter. Voting matters. And it
mm-hmm.
always has, but it's just the fact that we have been, you know, been an hoodwink when it comes to this particular issue. But well said, well said, well said. All right, it's time for the top of the hour. We're going to take another quick break, and when we return, we're going to do Black Acre at the top of the hour. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Gema, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Gema. And Ask Gema says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I wanted to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook. Patrick.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon says he disagreed with the decision to release a surveillance video purportedly showing teenager Michael Brown robbing a convenience store before he was shot and killed by local police. NPR's Nathan Rott reports that the video's release caught state officials off guard and renewed outrage over Brown's shooting.
Missouri Governor Jay Nixon says that he and other state officials didn't know that the surveillance video was going to be released. Appearing on NBC's Meet the Press, Nixon says that the videos released by Ferguson police put the community and the nation on alert again.
To attempt to, in essence, disparage the character of this victim in the middle of a process like this is not right. It's just not right.
Nixon says that he has talked with local police about that decision since it was made. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
Kurdish forces swept through villages around Mosul Dam today, backed by airstrikes from Iraqi and U.S. planes. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports that Peshmerga forces are said to have retaken most of the dam from Sunni jihadist fighters.
With more than a dozen airstrikes by the U.S., according to the military's central command, Kurdish forces pushed through ground formerly held by extremist fighters calling themselves the Islamic State and attacked Islamist positions at the dam itself. Multiple Peshmerga sources claim to have complete control of the dam by nightfall, but other officials said fighting was continuing. Retaking the dam is seen as essential to avoid a breach that could threaten cities downstream on the Tigris River. Kurds say they're relieved after their military suffered embarrassing defeats at the hands of Islamic State fighters. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Northern Iraq.
Concern is mounting in Liberia about the possible spread of Ebola in the capital after a clinic housing suspected carriers of the virus was vandalized. NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton says up to 20 patients reportedly fled the armed attack on the quarantine center.
Witnesses describe how young men armed with clubs and claiming Ebola does not exist broke down the door of the clinic in West Point, the biggest shantytown in Monrovia. Residents had opposed the establishment of the center set up by the Liberian health authorities in that part of the city deemed an Ebola epicenter in the capital. Reports say some residents were so angry that patients from other parts of Monrovia who tested positive for the virus had been brought to the holding center that they went on a looting spree, stealing items including medical equipment and mattresses, on Saturday night. Liberia currently has the fastest growing number of Ebola cases, and its post-war healthcare system is totally overwhelmed by the outbreak. Afabia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Accra.
Foreign ministers of Ukraine, Russia, France, and Germany are meeting in Berlin today, resuming diplomatic talks to try to find a political solution to the crisis in eastern Ukraine. Germany's foreign minister says a political solution can't be neglected. This is NPR News. In northeastern Arkansas, a train fire has been put out and about 500 evacuees have been allowed to return home. Officials with Union Pacific say two of their workers were killed, two others were injured when two freight trains carrying toxic substances collided and caught fire earlier today. The Arkansas Department of Emergency Management, though, says no health hazards were detected from the fire. Scientists have discovered a genetic explanation for how Tibetans can live comfortably at altitudes that would cause most people to have problems breathing. NPR's Joe Pelka has more.
The Tibetan Plateau is nearly 15,000 feet above sea level, and at that altitude, there's less oxygen in each breath of air you take. One way our bodies react to low oxygen conditions is to make more red blood cells. Red blood cells are the ones that carry oxygen to the tissues in our bodies. But an excess of red blood cells can cause health problems, such as heart failure. Now, researchers at the University of Utah have found a genetic change in people living on the Tibetan Plateau that prevents the buildup of red blood cells while still allowing them to get sufficient oxygen into their blood. The change is in a gene that regulates red blood cell production. The work appears in the journal Nature Genetics. Joe Palka, NPR News.
At the box office this weekend, The Turtles reigned. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is the top movie for a second weekend in a row. It took in an estimated $28.4 million. Coming in second, The Guardians of the Galaxy, that's in its third weekend, taking in an estimated $24.7 million. And in third place, Let's Be Cops, that came in with $17.7 million. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. We're getting ready to take a look at the Ferguson case in a different way. And in fact, we are going to do this through the lens of a gentleman named Leo Baron Hicks, through his blog entitled Black Acre Policy Forum. So I encourage you to go out to blackacrepolicyforum.org. That's B-L-A-C-K, Black Acre, A as in Alpha, C as in Charlie, R as in Romeo, E as in Echo, Black Acre Policy Forum, all one word, .org, and take a look at the blog. It is an outstanding piece of writing. And in fact, in today's fast-paced journalism society where we have people just putting out things quickly, you will find a lot of pleasure in really reading this blog. And I'm going to share some of it with you today, and it's in the context of what's going on in Ferguson. So I encourage you to go out there and take a look at this, but it is certainly something that we want to do. It's time for Black Acre Policy Forum, a progressive think tank founded by Leo Baron Hicks, a place where a new dialogue concerning public policy can find innovative strategies and bold solutions. Welcome to Black Acre Policy Forum.
I'm able to see clear the right, cause Lewis H. Lattimore improved the life, and J.A. Burr invented the lawnmower. Let me expand the mind of all you young soldiers. Sarah Boone invented the...
Today's title is called Social Death and the Process of Otherification. Social Death and the Process of Otherification. Now, recent events have called into question the soul of the nation. The city of Ferguson, Missouri, is now embroiled in a clash between the police and its minority population. The immediate cause of the conflict is the killing of yet another unarmed black male by yet another white police officer. A recent U.S. article entitled Local Police Involved in at least 400 Killings Per Year underscores the problem. According to the most recent accounts of justifiable homicide during a seven-year period ending in 2012, a white police officer killed a black person nearly two times a week. There is every reason to believe that the situation is materially worse than reported. When it comes to the use of deadly force, justifiable homicides are self-reported, and not all police departments participate in the reporting process. The numbers are not audited and are conflicted by independent measures of police-related fatalities. The database, therefore, underrepresents the actual number of these killings. Additionally, the criminal justice system automatically assumes that the use of deadly force against an officer is almost never justified. Not surprisingly, the same system is persuaded that the use of deadly force by an officer is often, if not always, justified. Partial listing of justifiable homicides and abuse of black male alone is considerable. There include not only Michael Brown of Ferguson, Missouri, but Eric Garner, an unarmed African-American male who died from an illegal chokehold administered by the Staten Island, New York Police Department. Antonio Baez, killed by the New York City Police, also by a way of deadly chokehold. Sean Bell, who was shot 50 times by the same police force the night before his wedding. Noel Polanco, an unarmed National Guardsman, who was shot and killed by a New York detective during a routine traffic stop. Ramali Graham, an 18-year-old male who was gunned down by a New York police officer in his own home in front of his grandmother and 6-year-old brother. Jordan Baker, a father and college student who shot and he was shot and killed by an off-duty Houston police officer. James Boyd, a homeless man shot to death by an Albuquerque, New Mexico police. Amado Diallo, beaten and raped with a broom handle in a public bathroom by New York City police officers. Gur Grant, shot and killed by a BART police officer in Oakland, California, as he lay face down on a subway platform surrounded by other armed officers. Mr. Grant's death was subject of the movie Fruitvale Station. Then there's Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis. Two unarmed black teens were shot and killed by George Zimmerman and Michael Dunn, respectively, two white males who felt threatened by their mere existence. Renisha McBride, a single black female, was shot in the face with a shotgun by a white homeowner as she sought her after a car accident. And recent videotaping of a white police officer on top of a prone black woman repeatedly punching her in the face, full force, with a closed fist. These types of deadly encounters occur with such frequency as to beg the question, so what else is new? Some would argue that these acts of violence are prime examples of America's lingering propensity towards racism. Race is certainly a factor here, as in the moral bankruptcy of the criminal justice system and our own culpability in these matters. But neither race nor its ism tells the whole story. Women, children, the elderly, the handicapped, immigrants, and the LGBT community are routinely victimized, regardless of their ethnicity, and horrendous acts are committed by every group against all groups. Something more is afoot. That something is what Blackacre calls otherification, alternatively known as dehumanization, social death, social categorization, or pseudo-speciation. Otherification is the process by which an individual or group is made something other than human. It is akin to forcing an entire class of people to check other box on an application. And there is a well-practiced process and procedure for this occurrence. First, an us versus them scenario is created by focusing on our differences rather than our similarities. This is usually accomplished by noting and emphasizing a clearly distinguishing characteristic of that targeted group. For example, race, skin color, gender, appearance of, or disability. If no such distinguishing characteristics exist, one will be created. The Nazis did so by forcing the Jews to wear a yellow Star of David. This situation can also be achieved via some status determination such as national origin, health consideration, physical, mental, or emotional disability. A deeply held belief or practice like religion, political party, or a group affiliation will also suffice. For example, from the very onset of the Republic, the Constitution referred to African Americans and Native Americans not as American citizens or person, but as others. Blacks were slave chattel and referred to as apes, bootlips, jigaboos, and every popular N-word you can think of. Native Americans were called savages and timber or forest Negroes. During the 1950s, the word communist was a mark of condemnation, while today the term socialist, terrorist, or Muslim apply. Whatever the means, the goal is to vilify and to malign the targeted group, to attribute to them to the absolute worst in human behavior and values, to paint them as vile, unclean, diseased, immoral, violent, hostile, dangerous, criminal, angry, sick, deprived, sexually irresponsible, ignorant, predatory, lazy, or just plain un-American, in order to breed suspicion, fear, and contempt. The process of dehumanizing further requires the separation and isolation of the targeted group from their general population. This is usually accomplished by some physical barrier or demarcation, such as wall or fence or gate or bridge or viaduct or railroad track, hill or body of water, zip code, if I may add. Separation, isolation might also be achieved via a street, housing project, or neighborhood, jail cells and prison bars, and also of frequent use. However said, separation and isolation need not be physical. It may well include a cultural seclusion. All that is necessary is that the target group be politically, socially, or economically divorced from or shunned by the rest of society. And when it comes to codifying and making permanent the social death of a people, nothing is more useful than the law. Thus, the legal and political systems are brought to bear, dubbed the terrible transformation during the mid-1600s, with the passage of a series of laws by colonial state legislators. The status of African Americans gradually but inexorably changed from indentured servants to race chattel slaves. Eventually, whether by law enforcement or the nation's armed forces, military action is employed. The busting and rolling of heads is necessary to protect the general public, to keep the natives in line, and to reinforce the social death of the target class. As the above examples illustrate, once a group loses their humanity, no mistreatment is too severe. The control and or elimination of said group is not only defensible, but is morally required by any means necessary. In conclusion, the loss of Michael Brown, the subsequent militarization of Ferguson, Missouri, and the other justifiable homicides referenced above are deeper than simply ethnicity. They are instead examples of the dehumanization of an entire class of people. As such, the query is not whether we are seen as black. The question is whether we are viewed as human. Leo Baron Hicks, founder and CEO of Black Acre Posse Forum. Leo, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it.
Man, what another powerful piece. It's so much packed in to this particular segment this week, and there's a lot to unpack over the series of events that happened in Ferguson. I want to begin with first, why write this blog, and what were you getting at here?
Well, not only did I want to analyze the Ferguson situation. Not only did I want to explain it, but I wanted to go deeper than that. I wanted to show the absolute depravity of what's happening to us and explain why that depravity is occurring. It's more than just our murder and our discrimination. It is the way that we are being desecrated, the way that we're being violated. And I wanted to explain that, and the best way I could do so was to show that some people simply do not view us as belonging to the human species.
Well, that's interesting, especially in today's society. And I say that in the context of years ago, centuries ago, we were seen not as humans, but as three-fifths of a human. And so even in our legislation, we were considered not totally human. And so what I gather from your comments and your blog and certainly your statement is that that notion exists today.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how else do you explain, for example, police officers that not only shoot unarmed African Americans, but gun them down in a hail of 50 bullets? I mean, the one individual that's mentioned in the blog that was shot 50 times on the night before his wedding, he was dead probably with the first bullet, or certainly the second and third bullet. What is the justification, therefore, for pumping 50 bullets in a person who died a long time ago? And the only thing I can come up with is because the people who did the murder did not see that individual as a human being.
Wow.
Not even dogs. Yes. Not even dogs are shot 50 times.
That's a pretty powerful statement, especially when you're talking about the idea of going to hunt, and you mentioned dogs and people like that. They don't shoot that many bullets in animals.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you kill a rabid dog, you don't shoot them 50 times.
Right, exactly. So what's troubling for me is the fact that this is coming from people that are in position of perceived authority, and authority in the sense that they have positions that have clearly been established by law to have a position over citizens in particular situations. And when you look at that, there is some inherent responsibility of those positions, one of them being at least a fair and balanced approach to any situation. So if a person that is supposed to be in a position of authority, is supposed to look at a situation through a particular lens, is acting in this manner, i.e. the police killing citizens, then you can expect a worse situation, a situation to be much worse when it's a civilian dealing with African Americans or any other population. So what is it about these people in positions of authority that we can't get a handle on for them to continue to conduct themselves in that manner?
Well, again, if you are dehumanized, if you have been stripped of your personhood, if whomever is dealing with you does not see you as a person, anything goes. For example, in the 1870s and 80s and 90s and all the way up to about 1950, African Americans were routinely snatched off the street and lynched. And they weren't only killed, but the bodies were desecrated. They were castrated. Holes were punched into the bodies. They were burned. People would cut off their ears and pull out their teeth and cut off their fingers for souvenirs. They would take pictures of the corpses. They would drag the corpses through the street and hang the corpse on telegraph poles in black communities in front of black schools. That is the level of desecration that we were dealt with then. And again, if you've got a vermin in your house, you know, if you've got a rat that you want to get or a squirrel that's in your attic, you catch them. But you don't cut off the squirrel's tail and hang it up. You don't take pictures with the squirrel. It is the complete and total dehumanization that explains that level of depravity with which some people treat us.
You know, that's interesting. I wonder then, what is contributing to this view of that society? Meaning that what is contributing to a person's ability to desecrate another person? They're not born in that situation. That's certainly nothing that's taught in our school system. There's certainly not something that the DNA that makes up the fabric of an individual that way. So what is contributing to a particular individual's mindset or psyche, a state of mind, when it comes to looking at African Americans in such that way?
Unfortunately, I think it is African Americans in large part. I think the images that we project, that the conduct we engage in, the hijacking of the black middle class culture that valued family and education and law-abiding behavior by the thugocracy and pimpology that too many of our young people engage in now is a real and material problem. We have a definite problem with the branding and images of African Americans that comes from African Americans.
Do you think the media has a role in the images that are being portrayed? I say that only because when you look at the fact that primarily African Americans you know, who violate themselves and that of others are normally done in their own neighborhoods. Black-on-black crime, as I put in air quotes, is one example of that. You know, the looting of their own communities, rioting in their own communities, stealing from each other, no snitching laws and stuff like that. That primarily is control within an environment which is not always highlighted upon. So from a national perspective, that's not always seen. But when I go and turn on a TV show, I now get this image being projected at me of or a role being played by a certain individual, then that becomes my perception of that individual, unbeknownst to me what's actually happening in the neighborhood. Or when I go into a mall and I see, you know, the Source magazine with thugs on them and the articles talks about, you know, these certain things, or the representation of a billboard as I drive down the highway. Certainly I don't have, or those communities don't have the means to put up billboards or to distribute magazines, nor do they have the means to really, distribute TV shows. So do you think that media has a role in that as well, or is it just kind of the African-Americans putting themselves in that position?
Well, I mean, clearly the media has a role in it, but let me add a few balancing comments. You asked, what is the reason that some people don't see us as human? And I mentioned the images that we project ourselves. Let me also add, clearly racism is a problem. And I don't mean to diminish that at all. There is still a lingering racist element in this country that has always dehumanized African Americans. So let me make it clear. But also, I think the last time we talked, or maybe another time before that, I mentioned to you, have you ever run across a situation where a car pulls up next to you, or you walk past the car, and there's an African-American blasting the most obscene music you could ever think of, with N-word this and B-word this and punk and MF and just outrageous music, blasting as loud as it can, and normally with a young child in the car. I'm sure you've run across that situation more than once. You can't blame that situation on the media because that's an individual thing, and I would guess that everybody in your listening audience has run across that or seen a young black male walking down the street with his pants all around his knees, or seeing a young black woman with tattoos all over her body. Is media a problem? Clearly it is. But those examples exist in every community in America apart from the media.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's an excellent point, the fact that there is some culpability by, and specifically the African-American race, has in this perception of others of the entire race. It's unfortunate, however, that when you see one black, that is kind of, you know, it really sets the bar for all blacks. We really don't have any autonomy. You know, when you see a white person goes out and conduct a mass murder, you don't consider that to paint the whole picture of all white people being a mass murderer. So I certainly understand where you're coming with it, and it's unfortunate that we're painted in that way. But that is the case. And since that's the case, we must do a better job in presenting ourselves or conducting ourselves better. So I want to ask you now, you got a comment?
No. Well, yeah, I do. You know, you mentioned, is it the media's fault? Let me add some additional balancing comments. During the civil rights era, there were courageous African-Americans who suffered bull Connors and rabid dogs and fire hoses and burning buses and everything that you can imagine to advance the cause of African Americans during the civil rights movement. These African Americans and white Americans who marched with King over the Pettus Bridge, they were brave, they were courageous, they wore suits and ties, they were respectful, they had the moral high ground. And the media did an excellent job of portraying those African Americans and their courage and commitment to the cause. So you can't say on the one hand that the media is all bad when they portray images of African Americans at their absolute worst now, and then ignore the great job that the media did in portraying progressive and courageous and noble African Americans during the Civil Rights Movement. And the only difference is the images that African Americans themselves projected to the media.
Excellent point. However, I would suggest that today's media is entirely different, has an entirely different agenda than the 60s media. You had true reporting of the news, where now you have more of a commentary. You have more of a, not even being news reporters, they like to drum up basically drama. So it's not about reporting the news. I mean, let's take Ferguson, for example. Now, there could be an enormous amount of coverage of the police officer himself, Darren Wilson. There could be an enormous amount of questions being posed about the autopsy. There could be an enormous amount of questions posed about the timeline and the distance between the convenience store robbery and the place where he died. There could be an enormous amount of questions about whether or not the delay of the autopsy being because of toxicology reports. There could be a lot of that, but the focus is on the rioting, is on the looting. Not to say that they're not both taking place, but the concentration because of ratings, because of what drums up drama, what keeps people's attention these days is that, as opposed to the issue to get to the bottom line. And I certainly would suggest that, yeah, you know, that, again, that is a situation where they're bringing upon themselves, but the media has a responsibility to cover both, not just and, not just or in that situation. So certainly the media has a role to play and has played an enormous role, but the focus have shifted tremendously from then to now.
My only problem with that analysis, though, is that if you say it's the media, if you focus on what the media is doing wrong, we can't control the media, but we can control ourselves. And we need to stop feeding those negative images by our own behavior. Let me give you something that troubles me, for example. I understand that what the police officer did was horrendous. I make no excuses for him, no apologies for him. If he did wrong, he should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But I do find it interesting that we engage in such moral outrage about that situation, but we don't march and protest the 80 people that were killed in Chicago over one weekend. Where is the balance there? Why is it wrong? And it clearly is wrong for that police officer to do what he did. But when it comes to Chicago, for example, or what Ferguson does to each other, because Ferguson is a low-income minority community, and I bet you there has been a lot more killings of black males by other black males in Ferguson than by white people. Police officers, I just don't see that same balance of outrage within the African American community.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. And we mentioned that at the top of the hour, that the fact that, you know, that is taking place, and we certainly want to address that, but that still doesn't dispel the notion that the police officer, a man of authority, a pattern of behavior for this police department, is certainly wrongs too. So there's not the case that we shouldn't be doing one or the other. We should be addressing both situations. And it's just now the focus is on the police officer, which hopefully turned this moment into a movement where eventually we get to a place where this won't happen by a police officer or no other person. And that goes back to your blog. I mean, the otherification is not just affecting white people or people in the majority class. Is also affecting black people. Obviously, they don't see each other as human either if they're conducting themselves in that manner. What do you think about that?
Precisely my point. I mean, if you were to do a comparison, I think the blog mentioned that during like a 8-month period or whatever in 2012, police over the entire country were involved in 400 killings, right? Yep. How many killings do you think were committed by blacks against other blacks in that same period?
At least triple that much.
At 10 times that much.
Yeah.
10 times that much. Now, again, that's not an excuse for the dehumanization of African Americans. That's not an excuse for the racism that we have to endure. That's not an excuse for the media's role in projecting the absolute worst about us. But hopefully it does put the comments and the problem in some sort of balance.
Absolutely. I want to keep you on the line, Leo, if you don't mind. I want to bring Jima in right now. I see her back on the line. I want to kind of get her take on this. And then I want you to address something from a legal standpoint, and that is this notion of this felony, fleeing felon. The fact that he can potentially, Brown can be potentially looked at as a fleeing felon being shot in the back or being gunned down. Is that justifiable? And so we'll talk about that in just a moment, but I want to bring Jima in. Jima, did you hear any of the comments that Leo made about the otherification and the description of that? You have any comments?
I just got back on, so I only just heard the tail end of you guys' last bit of your conversation. But I think what's important to remember is, and you were alluding to this as well, is and I believe Leo. It's just not a it's not either or, but it's a both and. And I think the outrage that does happen sometimes in the city of Chicago doesn't get the media attention that it gets. I know that on the ground several times this year alone, I know Reverend Sharpton has been up there. He stayed in the project where some things were happening there for a whole week and held different meetings and talked to people to try to figure out what he can do and what others can do to help the city of Chicago. I know Reverend Jackson is there doing things on the ground all the time, but it goes back to your point, Leo, that you make often, and I mentioned this earlier, and that is the point of as much as people come in to show care and concern, the people in that community have to show care and concern. And if you know who just did this drive-by down your street, you sitting in the house not telling nobody isn't helping anything. And so if those people in the community aren't moved enough to help themselves out of their current situation, why should I be more concerned about something that's happening to you? And so I think that's where we get to the both and not the either or. I'm concerned as a citizen, as an African-American female raising a young African-American male child, where we are in this country as it relates to our laws and policies and procedures and practices in our criminal justice system in its totality. I am concerned, having been involved in the criminal justice system, so I understand that. But I think the other about where is the outrage, the people in the community aren't outraged. And why are they not? And when they do get outraged, do their voices get stifled because, oh, it's just another shooting in Chicago? Have we become desensitized to the city of Chicago but not the city of Ferguson? If the same thing had happened in the city of Chicago, would the response from the nation be the same? Or is it because it's in a small town, suburb, you know, outside the city limits of St. Louis that we're concerned, not suburbs, concerned about it? Or if the exact same thing had happened in Chicago, exact same scenario, would we be outraged? And I don't know the answer to that. I would hope that we would, because we started the fire with the young man that was killed in New York, and we, you know, the pressure is to keep that on. But there's so many, I mean, it's like every week, and we talked about this last week, week before, there's a different shooting. There's something, you know, that happens. And so we've got to stay vigilant about all of it. I don't think we have the luxury of picking and choosing whether to be outraged. I'm outraged by all of them. And I think we should be outraged by all of them. And then we have to decide, okay, now what am I going to do with that anger? And as I have stated in the first segment, well, you got 20,000 people and you only have 1,500 people show up to vote. Okay, that's a problem. Who should be outraged about that? So, you know, we have to figure out how we're all impacted and affected by these things that may not happen directly in my neighborhood or even in my city or even in my county, but somewhere in the state of Texas this is happening, and I need to be aware of it. You know, I need to be concerned, and I need to try to ensure that I'm going to be as outraged about the officer, whether he's black or white, that kills an unarmed person, whether he's black or white.
the issue to me is the same. It's just not right. So if I value life, I value life, whether it's black or white.
Yeah.
And can I just add to that for a minute, sir?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, when it comes to the social death of African Americans, because that's really what we're talking about. That's the subject here. If our own kids self-identify as thugs and gangsters and pimps and players, if our own culture refers to other blacks as the N-word, fool, the fool, dog, the B-word, if we gun each other down and dog each other out and disrespect each other at a moment's notice, why should anybody else respect us? That's the problem I'm having in terms of the social death and the dehumanization of African Americans. We do as much as we can to dehumanize ourselves.
You know, the only thing I would ask that, you know, when you talk about the social death, is it really more or less a broken fingernail as opposed to an entire body being decimated? And I say that because you mentioned all of the perceptions that we see of the of being portrayed of African Americans and doing these things. But are the numbers that large that is really causing that type of impact, or is it the case that it's being covered more than the positive cases of happening in our society? For example, when you have a case like Ferguson, clearly you mentioned 10 cases that got a lot of coverage of police officers killing a black man. But is that the reality across the America, or is it just the fact that those 10 cases got a lot of coverage because they were so horrific?
You mean is black on black crime and fratricide the reality, or is it the highlighted exception? Is that the question you're asking?
Yes, that is the question.
The unfairly highlighted exception?
Exactly right.
No, I think that's the reality. I mean, the African Americans, the murder of African Americans are caused by other African Americans 94% of the time. 94% of the time that black people are killed, they're killed by other blacks. That is not a perception problem. That is a reality problem. Young black men walking around sagging and referring to African-American women as the B word is not a perception problem. It is a reality problem. Now, that's certainly not all African-Americans, but it is a substantial percentage of African-Americans. And we do ourselves a great disservice when we try to blame others for that.
So, but where's the balance in that, though? I mean, if it is true that there should be some cases where I see some positive stories, some positive images, right? I mean, if it's 94% of the time, 6%, I don't see the other 6% being reported. So it just leads me to believe that everything that I see that's being covered about an African American, whether it be them calling a black woman the B word, or where they're sag and things of that nature, I don't see the other side. So it's hard for me to believe that's what make us all up, right? That is who we are. It's hard for me to believe that. It's hard for me to buy that when I know hundreds of people that are not doing that.
Well, I mean, I see those positive portrayals of African Americans, though. I mean, I see that certainly in the media, where African Americans do great things and are exalted for the good that they do. Now, I mean, it's hard for me to come up with one right off the top of my head right now, but I see it all the time, though. I mean, I really do. Black people who are achieving greatness. Look at DiGrazio, the astrophysicist, the black astrophysicist. He's prominently displayed and celebrated for his uniqueness and his contribution to American society and its intelligence. I mean, I see it, quite frankly. But again, though, the dehumanization is a real problem with our community, and we have got to do a better job of branding ourselves. Because one of the things that you brought up is you brought up the media, but a lot of the media is controlled by African Americans. Take BET, for example. I can remember when BET first started, it highlighted entertainers like Gladys Knight and the Pips, mm-hmm. People who had real professionalism and class. And now you look at BET, and the only thing they're showing is sagging, rapping, gangsters and thugs. Now, that's a little bit overstated, but I think you get the point.
Yeah, and we know that BET is not black-owned anymore. It's owned by Viacom, and so I think, again, the media is portraying what they want people to believe, and I think that has a lot to do with the contribution of dehumanization. I think the otherification is certainly being perpetuated by the African-Americans themselves. They do have a role in that. But I think that is also highlighted by if you portray more of these activities on the positive side, or at least less of those activities on the positive side and more of those activities on the negative side, because you have a choice what to display. You have a choice on what to report. And so if you continue to choose to report or show me movies or play songs and contribute to the negative, to tearing down, to the decimation of African Americans, then quite naturally, people that come over here from other countries, that's who they think we are. They think all of us are like that because that's what they see the media being portrayed. Now, again, I certainly concede the point that we play a large role in that. But I think that is highlighted by the fact that what the media choose to play in most of those cases. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Again, the number is 323-580-5712. Leo, before we leave, I want to take a call, and I want to hear from our listening audience out there and see what they have to say. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick. Give us your name and where you're calling from. Last four, 2200. Yes. You're on
air. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, my name is Marwar, and I'm calling from Houston, Texas. And I study anthropology, and I'm actually teaching economics as well. And a lot of the comments I'm hearing, and I'm one of the young brothers. I'm 28 years old. And a lot of the comments I'm hearing which are good to an extent, but this is one thing we have to realize, is that the younger generation are not listening to the elders anymore. So we're going into a transition period where now the younger generation, the ones that are sitting behind the computers, the ones that are going out clubbing and partying, that have intelligence, these are the young generations that need to step up and start teaching. When the civil rights was being fought, right, for black people, these were the younger generations that were really fighting for that. It wasn't the elders.
That's true.
The main ones that was fighting for that were the younger generation. So we have to do that once again. We have to go back to getting the young generation, as myself, which I'm doing at this moment as well, doing my part, to get to the younger and the youth that are growing up now, because they're not listening to Reverend Al Sharpton anymore. Nobody's listening to Jesse Jackson anymore. We need more people that are going to reach the younger generations that are young themselves. And another thing is when we try to condemn the people in these communities, we got to remember the black people in these communities that are shooting these guns, that are selling these drugs, where are they getting it from? They're not going to Vietnam. They're not going to Cuba. They're not going to Colombia. These things are being brought to these communities. So we have to look and take that into perspective as well. So before we condemn and just put everything on a certain nationality, we have to look at the broader perspective and look at where or what is the source where these things are accumulating and where are they coming from and how can we stop it. So, again, that is my stance on it, and I think a lot of us younger generations, including myself, I know I could do more, we need to come together and stop being intelligent behind the scenes and behind computers and start being intelligent up front physically and get to these people. Let them see you. Be in the streets. Be out there. Give them a message. Give them hope. We don't have that anymore. The younger the parents now are younger than they ever been. And, again, I'm young myself, but the point is I grew up differently, and I was one of the lucky ones. But I'm still not giving up on my people, and I truly believe in them and their salvation and true sovereignty. Thank you.
Excellent, excellent point. So, Jima, let me let you respond, and then, Leo, I want to get you to respond because I think I want to get both questions addressed. I mean, both issues that he brought out addressed. First, he talked about the younger generation and the fact that they were instrumental in the movement of the 60s, instrumental in a lot of the legislation that was passed, instrumental into how our society has laws in place. And then he also talked about the fact that these communities are now being brought these drugs or brought these situations or are not just establishing these situations themselves, but are being aided from outside sources. So, Jim, let me get you to respond, and then and Leo, we'll shift to you.
Well, I think the short answer, the short part of that is that, yeah, it would be great if there was more young people involved in the struggle and the movement and the process. But what we don't have the luxury of is waiting on them to decide who that's going to be. And so we can only pray and hope that they catch on to the fire, and as the situation presents itself, they find themselves ready to lead, ready to organize, ready to figure out what policies and practices need to be addressed, when and how. So in each of these organizations that you have, you should have, in the civil rights organizations, you should have some young leaders coming up through the process. And if that is what we do, because as a leader, I always say I'm training my replacement because I have no desire to be in what I'm doing for the rest of my life. So I can only hope that people that are in positions of authority and leadership in these civil rights organizations currently are training up the next group or training up the next batch. But in the interim, I think those people that have that burning desire on the inside of them need to find their cause in their community. Start local. You know, what is the thing happening in your local school district, in your city council that you have some concerns about? And begin to use whatever talents you have to galvanize that and find your position and find a position that's going to be not only of a benefit to you, an individual, but to the community as a whole. The second part of that is, It's another of not either or, but both and. So, yes, we need additional help on the ground, whether that's from established leaders or those that are trying to find their way. We need both. We need the one that has never stood in front of a crowd but yet has the support of the people, and we need one that has the support of the people and has stood before kings and queens. We need both. And so I don't think we want to disenfranchise any side, and I think there's much to be learned that Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson or Mark Morial of the world, Ben Jealous, I think there's a lot to be learned in terms of strategy and what we should focus on and what lane each person should be in. But I don't think we have the luxury, because of the time we're living in, to wait for whoever that person is going to be. And who says we need one? I mean, there doesn't have to be a person. You know, do something in your own community and in your own neighborhood to help strengthen it. So you may not ever be on the national stage, but if you've made a difference in the lives of others, then you've done what you were set here to do.
Excellent point. Leo, let's take your comments on the issue. What do you have to say?
Well, look, there is nothing that I disagree with in terms of the comments of the gentleman made from Houston. Nothing whatsoever. I think he's absolutely right. I think that, unfortunately, young people are not listening to civil rights or the older civil rights leaders, in part because the older civil rights leaders are not relevant as a general rule, and also because the younger generation is not listening, period. And I think, you know, Jim, I know you love this quote or this phrase, that people like me have an obligation to reach back, but they have an obligation to reach up. And sometimes I think there's a disconnect on both parties, that we're not reaching back and they're not reaching up. But my goal of Blackacre is not to try to save the world, but just to move the ball downfield as far as I can and then hand it off to someone else. And you are the ones to tell me if I'm doing that and if I'm doing a good job of it.
The only thing I would say and on both accounts is the fact that I think there is a place for our elders in our society. I mean, they have the experience, they have the wisdom, they certainly have an understanding of the current situation on the ground. The second thing I would add is that it is good for me to look at King James play basketball, and it's good for me to remember, you know, how it was when I played basketball when I was younger. But it's another thing for me to get out there on the ground and start playing against that talent, right? And so I would suggest that before the younger generations take that leap and get into the game, that they go out and seek counsel from an Al Sharpton or Reverend Jackson Jackson or any of the civil rights leaders to at least get a smooth transition or at least get a status update. If they understand that language or terminology, to at least get an update on the current situation on the ground. Because what we see in the media is not always a reality on the ground. And then the second thing is, it's all in well to say, yes, I want to go do it, but they are the ones that's out there doing it. I don't think at one time have I seen Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson say, no, I don't want you to go out there and do that. They have not once stopped a younger person or a younger generation from going out there and taking a step in that direction. So I'll be willing to bet they would welcome that because you, as the gentleman said from Houston, they're on the ground. They are closely connected to that community. They closely understand the demographics, the people, and everything that's surrounding that community. So why not allow them to get up there? But we don't see it happening. And so I think it's time for – this is a good opportunity for the younger generation to take that first step forward, for certainly to move the ball downfield, to continue because we got a long way to go. I mean, Leo talked about moving the ball downfield, but, I mean, in my estimation, we ain't crossed the 20-yard line yet. You know, so we still we certainly nowhere near midfield. And so I think we have a lot of work to do, and there's plenty of things for people to do, and it's just a matter of just going out there and doing it. All right, Leo, I want to wrap up the Blackacre segment, but I want to give you the last word here. What are your final thoughts?
Well, look, first of all, I always appreciate you. I mean, no question about it, and your show. But secondly, it is to echo the comments of the young man in Houston. I have not given up on my people. Love African Americans. I know that we have greatness within us, and my goal and Blackacre's goal is to ask those questions and to raise those issues which help move us forward.
Outstanding. Again, that's blackacrepolicyforum.org. Go out there and read the blogs. You got a lot of good conversation out there going, and I certainly endorse what he's doing out there. I would encourage you to go out there and take a listen because he stimulates not just conversation but action, and that's what I certainly like about what Leo's doing. So, again, Leo, thanks for joining us, and I look forward to talking with you next week.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. Have a great one.
You too. All right, Jima, final thoughts.
Did
You know, we have, there's much work to be done. There's enough work for all of us to do. And be the leader that you want yourself. You know, as I stated, be active in your child's community, in your child's school, be a member of the PTA, show up in meetings, show up at conferences, have that impact on your child that you say the world has. You be the best teacher that you can be. And if you don't know if you have all the skills, then try to improve upon yourself. You know, we can't keep giving ourselves excuses and way outs of doing things. You know, sometimes we stay in situations because it's comfortable, and we've got to be pushed and prodded sometimes out of our comfort zone. And so as we look at the state of Missouri, the city of Ferguson, the county of St. Louis, we're looking at just a small speck of America, United States of America, this land of the free and home of the brave, right? You know, this place that says, you know, you're tired and you're poor, this place that said that all are welcome, you know, come and your dream. So if those are the lenses in which we were built and founded upon, then we have some cleaning up to do, because that's not who we've become. And so we need to clean off those lenses and begin to see them and see each other again as we once were seen. And so for those of us that were always seen at the bottom of the rung, you don't have to stay down there. I know we came in chains and in the bottom of a boat, and some of us didn't quite make it. But those of us that did, we are the strong ones. And so it's in our DNA to survive. We don't have an option. You know, we are the survivors. And so because we're here, we survived that middle passage. Part of us to keep fighting and to keep moving and to keep growing and to keep pushing. And so we can't bow down. We cannot allow ourselves to get hoodwinked into thinking that all is well because we have a black president. Laws have changed under this black president that are unprecedented. The Voting Rights Act, Civil Rights Act, things of those natures have changed since we've had this black president. So we better wake up and pay attention and get busy, get active, get motivated. We don't need another Michael Brown to motivate us. We don't need another Eric Garner. We don't need any other situation where a person is killed unnecessarily to motivate us. We can just look around and see that there's much work to be done. And what is going to be your rallying cry? You know, how are we going to stand up in the midst of all the obstacles that are before us and still stand strong? And whoever that leader is that's on the outline, that's on the peripheral waiting to jump in, I talk about this in my book about sometimes it's like we're jumping rope. And you know how you jump rope, you keep hesitating to jump in, waiting for that perfect time for you to jump on in. Well, it's time. Both feet in. Just jump on in and see what happens, because you'll never know if you're going to have an impact if you never jump in. And so I'm imploring and challenging all of us to just jump in. Find a cause in your community. Find a cause in your home. What could be done differently in your house? If you don't want to go outside, start in your own house, in your own family, of what you can do to have an impact on somebody else. And so that's where we are. And I just hope that as the weeks go on, we don't lose the fire and the energy about what we need to do in Ferguson, because it's what we need to do not only there, but all across these different cities and states across the country.
Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in. And, of course, a special thanks to my co-host, the wonderful, the magnificent, Jima Hill Cook. And you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at Ask Jima. That's AskJEMA. And certainly a shout-out to my man in Houston. Thanks for calling in. We look forward to seeing you next time. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. That's TAILORMADE Talk Radio. blogspot.com. Until next time, remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer in Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.